You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
This hour, we're in conversation with the author of the book, How to Steal a City, The Battle for Nelson Mandela Bay. And let me introduce him to you. This is his inside account to the best of his recollection of what he observed when he had a front row seat in various capacities, both being seconded by Luthuli House to try and help the ANC qua political party to restore itself to former glory in the area of Nelson Mandela Bay, but also from the point of view of local government to try and help out then minister in that portfolio, Pravin Gordhan, to try and deal with the rot that had clearly been setting in this particular municipality. And why was Crispian chosen, despite being a medical doctor by profession? Because he has, over the years, become an expert in public policy and management, not least because he himself has been within government in many senior managerial positions. He was a key part of thinking through the reconstruction and development plan. He was also, of course, at one stage, the Director General for the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. He's been involved as one of the architects that have actually had to think about the legislative architecture, in fact, for the country when it comes to local government, and overseeing many of the processes involved in establishing a number of key institutions in the country. So this man is not some random Joe Soap that is giving us his opinion. He really knows what he talks about, and he has the credentials and the CV to show it. He is in our Cape Talk studios. I don't think Crispian and I have ever met before, but having read this book, I feel like I know not just what has happened in Nelson Mandela Bay, but also a little bit about him as well. Crispian, good morning to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Eusebius, and thank you very much for having me on your show. Can I just apologize up front? I've got a raging cold, as you can hear, so I'm a little gruff. But I will try.
Well, that gruff. Gruff is sometimes sexy.
Yeah.
We'll take gruff.
I'm all yours. I have to say, you know, you might have got to know a little bit about me in the book, but I am a fan of your show. So I feel like I have a very intimate understanding of Eusebius McKaiser and all the tough, you know, emotive issues that you grapple with on the show.
Thank you. That's very kind. Let me extend the love, literarily speaking. I do not say this lightly, Crispin. I really mean this genuinely. I was saying it to Alistair Teeling-Smith, who also knows you upstairs here at work a little bit earlier this morning, that I honestly think your book needs to be selling like a Fetcook, at a bazaar. It is absolutely critically important. And I almost feel bad for being able to say such nice things about your excellent book, because I wish that we were here today to talk about the wonderful poetry related to a city you and I both love, Port Elizabeth.
Yes.
I could identify the beginning of your book with your description evocatively of, for example, that smell when you touch down and you're getting off the plane, you know, the breeze that comes in. But of course, sadly, today we're going to have to talk about the rot that had settled in. So I want to go straight for what I think is one of the hearts of the book, and we'll unravel it slowly over the hour. On page 48, this almost reads like a crime novel. Crispian writes the following. Over time, I was able to identify the different factions operating in the region and how they operated. When I arrived in Port Elizabeth, the dominant ANC faction was known as the Stalini Group, named after the community hall in PE where they held their meetings. This faction included former ANC regional leaders and most of the metro political staff we had just fired. I learned that the faction had emerged in the build-up to the 2007 Polokwane conference. The Stalini Group was initially a coalition of left-wing and nationalist forces in the region and included leaders of NUMSA and the SACP. After Mbeki's defeat at Polokwane, the pro-Mbeki faction in the region, known as Stepping Stones, and led by then ANC regional chair Mike Tlego and then mayor Nondumiso Maphazi, was purged and later disintegrated. You know, Crispin, the first thing I thought about was, my God, I feel like I'm reading here a description of turf wars between gangs on the Cape Flat, or Shakespearean characters of two famous houses that are about to be joined in union because of an unexpected love affair, perhaps by members of both of the famous Shakespearean houses. But of course, the reality is that we're talking here about people within the ANC and within the municipality that have been entrusted with a very important constitutional duty.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a sad fact that the ANC's really become increasingly characterized by factions. It's not their exclusive, you know, possession. I think we've seen factions emerging in other political parties here. But certainly since the Polokwane conference, I mean, there was a huge factional divide running into that conference. And I've been trying to grapple with this problem of why. Because, you know, these factions are... I mean, it's unbelievable. They take their conflict so seriously that they see the danger of the other faction inside the same organization as greater than any external threat. And they're prepared to almost die in pursuit of a factional struggle, even if it kills the... You know, I was a little bit involved in student politics in the early 80s. And we had this similar sort of factional battle between the populists and what we call the ultra left, which was also a sort of, you know, die in the ditch kind of struggle. And in the bigger picture of things, you know, we were all on the same side. We were all fighting the same enemy. But jeepers, we went to enormous lengths to punish and take out and weaken the other side.
You write, and you've come back to it over the past week as we're hearing the testimony of very brave men and women like Themba Maseko and Phumla Williams, the importance of good men and women, whether they are of a political background or technocrats, apolitical, internal auditors who do amazing work and who can't see wrongdoing without speaking up. Your first encounter as you were tasked by Pravin and Luthuli House, respectively, to try and deal with a crisis in the municipality and the party in PE, you've encountered so many people, and I want us to honor some of them. And of course, we are all messy and complicated and imperfect. But the first person to really spill the beans that gave you your first outline of what might be going on in the details of Nelson Mandela Bay was Maria Hermans, the speaker of Nelson Mandela Bay. Introduce her to the public.
So Maria is a fascinating and very compelling character. She comes out of the unions. She had been linked a little bit to the NUMSA team. So she's sort of slightly on the left of the group. I think she was even with the Stalini faction at one particular point in time. But Maria is a woman of very strong principle. She's got a child with Irvin Jim, and him breaking away, the NUMSA breakaway, does her causes her quite a bit of trouble because she's now being attacked. Gwede Mantash once confronted me about Maria and said, no, she's a spy. Everything she listens to in ANC meetings, she goes and tells Jim afterwards, which was just rubbish, actually. And Maria, during the worst of the looting in Nelson Mandela Bay, was very much isolated as speaker. And she was sort of keeping the flag flying. She supported the city manager, Lindy Msingane Ndlela, when she was being victimized by Uamben.
Yes.
And I bump into Maria at a SALGA conference nationally. And, you know, we go, she says, listen, I can't talk openly. We need to go somewhere. So we find a little room and we sit down and she bursts into tears, which, I struggled a bit as to how to cope with that.
Despite the glass of wine at the holiday.
She just then said, you know, I am so scared. I am so frightened of what they're going to do to me. That was the start of a really strong relationship. I mean, she gave us, and by us, I mean sort of, because I was Pravin's proxy then.
Yes.
But our whole team in provincial and local government, and Pravin, she gave us our first comprehensive intelligence picture. You know, we subsequently had to corroborate a lot of what we had heard from her. But on the whole, she told it like it was. The picture she painted was extremely accurate.
So let's drill down into what that picture was, and you tell the story then over the subsequent chapters. I mean, chapter 6 in particular is critical to the story, lifting the lid and what's going on here. But when you arrive and you start speaking to a whole bunch of people, you try and triangulate what she had told you, you get introduced to other characters, you meet with an internal auditor who's quite feisty, who checks out your credentials before speaking to you at the beach hotel. And there begins to emerge this picture of exceptional relationships between private interests, party members, and then folks within the municipality, from Mako to other positions down. What is the picture that emerges as you find yourself both on the task team as well as the person seconded by Pravin?
Yeah, well, it took me a while to cotton on to the way the system was working. You know, initially I couldn't understand why, for instance, the city manager would agree to do things with us and then for some reason they'd be distorted or they wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of in theory understood what, you know, capture and corruption was, but I had no real sense of the scale of what I was dealing with. And at one point I sat down and I took a sort of highlighter and I went through each part of the organogram in the municipality and marked out who was, in my opinion, on the payroll of the syndicate or at least sufficiently orientated towards them to do their work. And when I finally understood, it took my breath away. You know, they controlled not just the city manager,
Okay, 21 minutes after 10. Let's take a quick break here, just a breather. If you've just joined us, we're speaking to Crispian Olfer about How to Steal a City. And I'll tell you what's amazing about this book is that basically he, in forensic detail, including other than where he needs to have people protected for security reasons even, names the names and tells the story, quite literally, of how Port Elizabeth was stolen.
Eusebius McKaiser on 702 at Cape Talk.
24 minutes after 10 o'clock, we're in conversation with Crispian Olfer about his excellent book that every South African should read, How to Steal a City, The Battle for Nelson Mandela Bay, An Inside Account. It really is a phenomenal story that exposes the machinations of corruption and, more than that, sheer criminality, even everyday criminality, not just white-collar crime, in terms of how private interests combined with careerism in the party and also some unethical and illegal behavior inside the municipality is the reason why Port Elizabeth currently is in the state that it is in and why the ANC ended up taking such an incredible hammering. Now, Crispian is coughing a little, but that's okay, Crispian. Just take a sip of water for me. We're grateful that you are here. I want to read from the book as we are getting to this question I've just posed to you about how exactly these networks work. On page 58... there was one of the more fascinating moments for me, and it really is like a spy novel. Crispian writes the following. Besides Bonnie and Werner, I found another mine of information in Kobus Gerber, the local representative of AfriForum, the Afrikaner civil rights group, and a key mover in the local ratepayers organization, I got my first real taste of the undercover world of informants and investigations when I met Kobus in May 2015. Pravin had suggested that I speak to him after Kobus had given him a file that supposedly implicated local officials and politicians in a massive fraud. The next paragraph, by the way, Crispian, had me chuckling at your description of this man. Mm. When I first called him, Kobus seemed suspicious of my intentions. We arranged to meet in a restaurant on the beachfront, and I arrived early to prepare for the meeting. I knew little about him, and I was a bit alarmed when a burly white man, who looked like an apartheid security policeman, walked through the side door of the restaurant with his hand on his hip. Was I being intercepted already? Then an even larger Afrikaner, with hands the size of dinner plates, came through the front door and walked up to me. His hand shot out, "Gerber, Kobus Gerber," he said. "I'm pleased to meet you." Now, one thing that is for me a learning moment at this point in the story is that we shouldn't be presumptuous that if someone is white or Afrikaans or comes from AfriForum, that they couldn't potentially be a very important part of the democratic project, Crispian.
Yeah.
So tell us more about him. And although not everything he said had firm evidential backing, he became an important next source for you in terms of leads.
Yeah, I mean, Kobus had been fighting a loan campaign. And for a number of years, he'd been just systematically pulling information together and following leads and documenting stuff. I think he had an intelligence background, although he never said that to me. But he certainly had the ability to pull information out from a very wide range of people. And he ran, you know, he was networked into the organization. And there were a whole lot of disgruntled, largely white staff that if they picked up something irregular going over their desk or they were given an irregular instruction, they would feed that through to Kobus. And Kobus sort of documented all of that. His problem was that no one ever took it seriously and no one had acted on the information that he had. So he was sort of delighted that someone from Pravin's office now was committed to actually following this all up and doing something about it. And we built up quite a relationship. You know, I had to, I learned over time not to trust everything he told me. And, you know, in this game, you've got to triangulate all your information. So I would always go and look for a second and a third or a fourth sometimes source. And, you know, Kobus's politics were strange. He's, you know, he's very much in the AfriForum mold. But he spent, you know, an enormous amount of time trying to convince me of his social intentions and his upbringing and how he wasn't racist. So, you know, I found him a complex character and a compelling character.
But it did allow you to get into the nuts and bolts, right? Because this is the bit where South Africans need to be vigilant about their cities. You write that there were four major areas of financial hemorrhage that Kobus was worried about. One, the metro's bus rapid transit system, or the integrated public transport system. Two, the management of the Nelson Mandela Bay Stadium. Three, land planning and management. And four, IT contracts. Now that matters because now you're beginning to see very precisely where in the governance structure the opportunities for looting exist and in fact then get exploited.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't realize how far the rot had gone into the municipality. But essentially they controlled all the key arms of the administration. They controlled the city manager, they controlled the head of legal services, the head of corporate services, they controlled the finance division.
Yes.
They controlled the infrastructure and engineering, particularly around the bus and the BRT, or what was called the IPTS. And they could engineer a MIMO to do a fraudulent transaction. From initiating the purchase order all the way through up through supply chain and get it back down and get it paid within a day, which I found a startling fact because, you know, we always talk about incapacity in government. But that sort of application of mind, albeit for corrupt purposes, demonstrates that there's nothing wrong with government capacity. It's the intention.
Nefarious intentions, yeah.
It's the intention. So,
but the amount of money then through those bad intentions that is lost to us to corruption is enormous because once you had a look at some of the documentation from Quibus, there was memos authorizing irregular contracts. The proofs of payments were there, company documents listing. You give one example in the book, for example, Crispian, you may recall of a property management company, Lamax, for example, that had received a payment in the order of 25 million rands, when in fact the limit on the contract that they ought to have been awarded was 9 million. That is a lot of money that can go to poorer parts of the city, including parts of the city where people like Danny, you know, Jordan comes from in the northern suburbs that are dirt poor, not to talk about some of the other townships as well, like Motherwell, etc.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't an area of the municipality that wasn't being milked. So you could almost go through every department. Human settlements, you know, all those big housing contracts, even the award of houses to individual people. I mean, they were auctioning positions on the list as part of the fundraising for the syndicate. In sports and recreation, they were running money through the Nelson Mandela Bay Stadium, that, you know, beautiful 2010 World Cup stadium that was built. Engineering, beaches and resorts, energy, waste management. So, or, you know, I was staggered at the amount of money that was pouring out of the municipality every month.
Chris, let's take a quick break there just for our news headlines. We'll speed up the story in the second half of the conversation. We'll ask what the relationship is between the party and the municipality in the region, what the relationship is between the regional structures and the provincial structures, and then introduce you to a couple more characters. And then we'll end the conversation by asking, what are the lessons, stepping back from the minutiae, that the country can learn about the entire state capture project nationally?
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702 at Cape Talk.
On page 46 in How to Steal a City, Crispian writes the following. The weakness of most branches meant that ANC ward councillors were not held accountable for their performance, which in turn left the municipality out of touch with the corners, with the concerns of its residents. Councillors were often more interested in advancing their own interests, and few bothered to attend branch meetings. Even fewer bothered to connect with their constituents and properly channel their concerns. During one of Jacob Zuma's visits to the region, he stopped by Ward 24 in KwaZakhele, where he found a very drunk councillor. The councillor accompanied the president to visit one of his constituents, who, upon seeing the councillor, exclaimed, "You, where do you come from?" Clearly, the councillor had not spent much time in his ward. On that same day, a young Muslim leader told the president that councillors spend their time drinking in taverns. Another person boldly said that the party was, quote, not choosing councillors who are acceptable to the people, but rather councillors who are loved by the ANC. "I'm just a little bit intoxicated," another ward councillor admitted to the visiting national leadership. JZ, who doesn't drink alcohol, was appalled. Now, Crispian teased this out for us, the weaknesses of the ANC from a political party point of view in terms of how many of the branches were not functioning properly, the gatekeeping to make sure that people who are not in your faction can't become members, the lack of auditing about who is a member in good standing in a branch that is actually properly constituted. There is a direct relationship between the hot mess of the party system within the region and the shenanigans that happened within the municipality.
Yes, I mean, I suppose you need to distinguish the way the system's meant to work. So, you know, you elect a ward councillor. That councillor's meant to represent the interests of the people of the ward, consult them, you know, lobby for them to get things done. And you've got to contrast that with the way that power is organized in political factions on the ground. And there, the sort of tradition was all about gatekeeping. And gatekeeping is the process of keeping members of your branch only allied to the faction that you support and excluding people from the branch that are not part of your faction. So you'll have, you know, many branches that are just pegged at 100 people. They don't want more people.
Yes.
It's just enough to legally constitute the branch, get the quorum, and you know that those people are going to support your political faction. So that's the sort of the building blocks of power in a factionalized organization. And it cuts across and undermines the, you know, this publicly stated decentralized bottom-up representative type of government that the ANC was trying to create. And I was startled at the contradiction. You know, I'd been in ANC politics in the 80s and 90s, and coming back sort of 20 years later, I was stunned by the lack of proper strategic and substantive discussion in the branches. We'd spend all of our time preparing for regional conferences, lobbying about who's going to support which factional slate, and not worrying about the real issues that we should be grappling with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kubis introduced you to another name, and this name for me, and this is why I have said to the public, the whole of today, your book pairs very nicely with Jacques Poe's book. Yours is the microcosm, whereas he is the national version of exactly the same story of the shadow state, Crispian. We even have our version of the Gupta family playing out in Eastern Cape politics. So on page 60, you may recall you write the following. Kubis proceeded to tell me how ANC politics and corruption had become intertwined with criminal networks in PE. All these scams had certain common features. Front companies linked to prominent local politicians were awarded contracts. A network of staff in budget and treasury processed unauthorized payments, while powerful but unseen players orchestrated the operation from behind the scenes. For the very first time, I heard about the man who had been supposedly cooking up some of these deals in cahoots with the ANC regional leadership. His name was Farid Fakir. "That man is very clever. He has many degrees," said Kubis. "I don't know how he gets it right." Kubis said that Farid Fakir was highly secretive and dangerous. "You can't get near him," he said. "There are only a few people who are allowed to talk to him, and he drives around in different vehicles, always with darkened windows." You then asked him, Crispian, "Do you know how Fakir got to be in the metro?" And you then write, "He told me that former mayor Nceba Faku had brought Fakir in as the local partner to a company doing the bus ticketing system. And according to Kubis, Fakir had operations in a number of cities, including East London." And so the story goes on. And then just quickly on the next page, Crispian writes this, which is extraordinary, the parallels with the Guptas. "So the National State Capture Inquiry, we are all watching on TV, listeners of Cape Talk and 702. One can imagine on Bay TV, a version of this playing out in Port Elizabeth. On page 61, the author writes, "Fakir apparently controlled politics as well. Kubis related a story from former mayor Zanokolo Wayile, a story that Wayile later confirmed to me and told me on national television. When Wayile became mayor, he was approached by Fakir." Doesn't that sound like faking mentors experience?
Yeah.
"We appointed you as a mayor," Fakir had apparently said, "because we have this project for you, the IPTS project. We need to tap money from this project." I mean, that is the shadow state nationally playing out locally.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, so, you know, Port Elizabeth is a little bit like Cape Town, where you've got a sort of criminal underbelly to the economy. The abalone poaching syndicates are big in PE. A lot of the northern areas, which were forcibly resettled under apartheid, are, you know, controlled by gangs and gangs of turf there. And I discovered that, you know, this criminal underworld interfaces with the formal world in a whole range of ways. And there are entrepreneurs that emerge out of it who build, you know, who spot the opportunity to basically buy an entire administration.
Yes,
they're able to attach a value to it, so they know all the different ways in which you can extract value, and they make a calculation. They, you know, they work out what is it going to take to buy the ANC in this area, and to bribe or control enough of the administration in order to get what I want. And this is so it's a sort of criminal syndicate that then gets established both inside the ANC and inside the city. It's not necessarily formally part of the ANC. I mean, I spoke to a lot of the old regional executive committee members who said these things weren't even discussed. There were some REC members that were hanging out with Fakir and were going to his house, and all the decisions were being made informally and off the record, out of sight. And I, you know, I finally met Fakir many months later. He actually came up to Johannesburg and agreed to have a meeting with me. And I asked him, you know, how much did it cost?
Yes.
To run this thing, and he said, "This was an expensive operation. You know, it was hundreds of millions rands a month." To sustain it, but clearly the returns were worth it. And you know, it is what stunned me was the sort of sophistication, the ability to think. I mean, the ambition of the thought, the idea that you could buy a city and take control of all of the processes around it stunned me.
You know, Crispin, one of the things that Mark Swilling explained so beautifully on my show a couple of weeks ago, it's been stuck with me even as the State Commission of Inquiry does really important and good and useful work. But there's a limitation to legal processes, as we know. They are useful, but they only get you so far to try and hold people accountable socially and politically and understanding the machinations of corrupt networks. And he made the point that Eusebius, and it's a bit difficult to explain, but if one has time, you can do it patiently to a non-expert audience, that there isn't always a conspiracy of people in one room who all know each other who deliberately plot a way to steal a city or a state. And secondly, that there is a systemic element or a systems analysis element here that is very important. And when you have individual actors that you obsess about, rightly so, a Jacob Zuma, a Bata Bele Dlamini, a Fakir in PE, you will get part of the picture, but never the full picture. So I mention all of that because when you write about Mben Fihla, And you try and get his opinion to what the speaker had told you. I mean, he seems kind of like nonplussed and almost in a daze when he says to you, yes, there are problems, but we are dealing with them. Yes, yes, yes. And then, of course, later on, we've got Denny Yordan being parachuted in. And I wonder to what extent they were all, even the ones who had good intentions as the various mayors or deputy mayors, the new ones that get appointed after you and Praveen fire a bunch of them, to what extent were they doomed to never deal with this thing really properly and ultimately in a way that roots it out, Crispian? Because I think we haven't yet fully grasped Mark Swilling's point about how these networks really, really operate, and sometimes they don't even all sit in the same WhatsApp group, which makes it very hard to get a proper grasp of what's going on.
I think you've put your finger on it. I mean, we're dealing with a deeply systemic problem. And by gazing up at the top and looking at the most egregious crimes and personalities, we are going to lose sight of what's really going on. And this thing is really built at a micro scale. It's built in the moral economy of our society. And we've got to start having moral economy kind of discussions. and approach those discussions with a degree of honesty, because we don't come to that table as innocents. I mean, you know, I describe some very serious crimes in PE, but the biggest crimes that took place in PE were, you know, the massive forced relocations that pushed people out into the northern areas and plunged them into decades of poverty, far from jobs and far from opportunities. Or, you know, the genocide that was run from the sort of British frontier post in the Zuurveld when they
cleared it
to make way for the 1820 settlers. You know, we're dealing with a city.
The lost boys of Bird Island.
Yeah, my God, the lost boys of Bird Island. I mean, so you're dealing with layers of pain and damage. I'm not trying to downplay the seriousness of the crimes of corruption, but you've got to see all these layers on top of each other.
But isn't that, and I want you to pause on my following question as we go to a break, isn't part of the painful truth, which is why some commentators and some academics use this really painful description, but they mean it analytically, that although we formally adopted democracy in 1994, we have elements of a neo-colonial state. And I wonder what your reflections are on the other side of the break of how the moral economy of the apartheid era that you've just described, unfortunately, some of that we have then reproduced in PE and elsewhere after 1994. Yeah. We'll get Crispin to reflect on that on the other side of this. 9 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're wrapping our conversation with author Crispin Olfer about the book How to Steal a City. Ketiwe, very quickly, what is your comment or your question?
Thank you very much, Isabias. Comrade Tipe, I've read your book, and it just my heart sank down. This is just one area you've managed to shine a light on.
Yes.
And I'm sure, and it's a macrocosm of what probably is happening throughout the country and what we don't know because it's not been reported in the media except for the Guptas. Do you really think this level of corruption can be uprooted in our country? And if so, how can it be done? What does it require for it to happen?
Excellent question. And I want to combine that question of whether you have hope, what we should do going forward, Crispin, with just tying up our look back to the past.
Yeah.
The moral economy of apartheid, 1994 was meant to be a clean moral break. It wasn't.
Yeah. It wasn't. And, you know, we're sitting here today while Marcus Joost is busy testifying in Parliament. And it just shows you that right at the top of the, you know, the capitalist system, there were equally deeply criminal elements who were out for their own interests. So I think if we want an honest reflection about state capture, there's got to be a level of introspection that is prepared to honestly look inside each one of us and ask the hard questions. There's a lot of finger pointing in this game, and I think that finger pointing is obviously correct in flagging corruption. And Ketiwe, you know, yes, I agree, this should not be happening in this country and it's morally outrageous. But to make that statement, we've also got to talk honestly about what each of us has contributed or brought to the table to allow this to happen. I have a lot of hope for the future. You know, we've seen an enormous number of really good principled civil servants who've stood up and resisted the kind of state capture processes. And the testimony from people like Pumla Williams and others has shown that, you know, these people are there. They've not bowed to pressure. And I think we can rebuild the civil service. We've allowed the politics to, in a sense, override and dominate our administrations in cities, in national and provincial government.
Yes.
In a way that's completely, you know, bizarre. You know, Faith Mutambi walking around demanding that she's called Honourable Minister by senior managers in her department. Who the hell does she think she is? We need to return to a situation in which we recognize the role of politicians, which is obviously to provide policy direction and to provide oversight and leadership, and the role of institutions and the role of administrators within those institutions.
But can I tell you in part who the hell she thinks she is? And it's my second last question to you, and I'd love to have you back on the show to unravel some of the issues I'm about to hint at, but just a top-line intuition. Right at the beginning of the book, you say something so remarkable that one could read it quickly and not really grasp the depth of the observation. When JZ calls you guys and say, come on, you are old cadres whose hearts are in the right place, we need you to do country duty and go to PE.
Mm.
He doesn't mention corruption once.
Yeah.
Later on in the book, you talk about how when the task team meets with the provincial and the local leadership in all sorts of capacities, they talk about what should happen to the new structures you're putting in the municipality, but there's no reckoning with their own contribution toward the rot. So who does Faithless Mutambi think she is? She is part of a network of top ANC leaders, both in provincial structures all the way to Luthuli House, who want to talk even when they are intervening in a crisis, as if the crisis doesn't have an immoral foundation.
Yeah. And they don't want to do the hard work of going back and taking a detailed look at why things went wrong.
Yeah.
And I've watched, depressingly, that scene get played out just far too many times. I mean, even post the 2016 elections loss, the level of introspection that you would have thought the ANC should have been doing nationally and regionally didn't happen. And there were profound lessons from the 2016 local government elections.
That's right. That's right. We've got 2 minutes left. You quote one of my, I call him a political analyst, and I know you've got the same respect for him. You quote a remarkably simple but critically important observation that Stephen Friedman has made, Crispian, which is to say that if you look at what's going on in the Eastern Cape, for many politicians, they don't have any other careers. And some of them end up making the wrong judgment calls ethically, because if they were to lose their jobs inside the party or inside municipalities, they could literally go from living in a nice 3-4-bedroom house, driving a BMW, to being dirt poor. And that's not to excuse their behavior, but if we are to understand in part what goes on in places like PE, we also have to reckon with how the legacy of apartheid has meant that for some people, politics is all they have and stands between them and politics.
Yeah.
And poverty.
Yeah. It's their meal ticket. And I was struck by the fact, I mean, I did my calculations on PE. I mean, there's probably about 1,000 branch executive members and senior politicians spread across the region, and the bulk of them are unemployed. Getting one of those limited council seats is absolutely life and death, and it's why councillors are prepared to, in some cases, go out and kill each other in order to secure that seat.
Yeah, that is absolutely frightening.
Anyway,
perversity. Thank you so much, Crispin.
My next book is on the city of Cape Town. Just to say, I'm busy.
Are you putting the DA on notice? Because Moose has been quoting your PE book left, right, and center last week.
It's partly in response to that, but I think there's a very interesting story to be told about the relationship between property and power. The way that in a supposedly well-functioning city,
that's right,
you still have this insidious affair
in which
money has infiltrated and manipulated power and administrative decision-making.
That is absolutely right. When can we look forward to it?
It's not before 2019, I'm afraid.
Okay. All the best. Congratulations. And I hope that you will get another incredible bevy of sales from this book. I'm certainly punting it, and I'm doing so honestly. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.